Hello and welcome to Stage as we are talking theatre. A little later on in the show, Trisha Stars will be giving us some what's on. But without further ado, I am thrilled to introduce our guest this evening, the esteemed Anita Hegg. She is currently starring on the Belvoir stage in A Room of One's Own, the classic Virginia Woolf. She has stomped the boards, rarely out of work since studying at NIDA in 94. She has worked extensively in theatre, winning both a Holtman and Sydney Theatre Award for The Wild Duck at Belvoir Street. She won a Sydney Theatre Award for the City at STC, a 2018 Holtman Award for Best Female Actor in a Supporting Role for The Resistible Rise of a Tour. Ooey, she was in Twelfth Night and The Seagull at Belvoir, A Cheery Soul, Harp in the South, The Father in the Cloud Nine at STC, The Anzac Project for the Ensemble and The Crucible and Top Girls for MTC. That's just the tip of the iceberg. I am so pleased to welcome Anita Hegg to Stages. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Regina.
Thanks for
your lovely
coming.
Introduction.
Thanks for coming on. So we'll get into what it's like to perform now on a stage during these times. But before we do, I want to try to get a little sense of how you came to be an actor. So what was life like growing up for you? Where were you? Where did you grow up and what was it like?
I spent the first few years of my life in Ocean Street in Woollahra. My parents rented this big house and then they subletted all these rooms upstairs, and we had my grandfather living with us for a while also. So there was quite a lot of activity in the first few years. And then we moved to Willoughby, and that's where I spent most of my childhood. And I went to Willoughby Girls and before that Willoughby Primary, which was sort of on the same block. So it was a very happy
small
suburban
world.
Small world. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. And a very introverted family, artistic but introverted. So there were no show ponies. My dad was, you know, quietly whittling away, carving and things like that. He was also a carpenter, and he'd been things like a shipwright before and a photographer and all those sorts of things. But when he had kids, he sort of settled into carpentry. And mum painted and sewed and all that kind of stuff. So they sort of had their little artistic pursuits, but there were certainly no actors in the genetic
strain.
Strain, yeah.
Yeah. So it sounds idyllic. But so were you a show pony?
I'm never quite sure, because my mum talks about me as being this lovely child and that I was really lovely. But my aunties and anyone who babysat me said I was terrible and it was just tantrums and I was noisy. And so I think I've got to go with the aunties there. I think I might have been a brat. But I felt on the inside I felt very, very shy. And I remember we had a teacher, Mr. Warwick, in primary school who was, you know, loved doing shows and putting on things. So he was always putting on productions and I never wanted to be in them. I wanted to be the tree up the back and I always wanted to hide. And that's sometimes something that I still quite like to do on stage. Sometimes I like to hide. So I don't know. It's a very strange, complex relationship I have with it all. I do love performing, and I obviously feel I need the attention in some way, and I like the escapism of it. I love having amazing words to say, but I'm also not great at things like publicity and putting on a frock and doing all that kind of stuff, you know. So I have a very, you know,
complex love hate.
Complex love hate with it. Yeah, yeah.
So do you think maybe you hide within the character? Is that something? Or?
I think that might have been it. I think I always felt probably in a classroom I wasn't the most vocal person, and I suppose I never felt particularly articulate. And I think when I was given full sentences to say and words, I could sort of put all the emotion and everything behind it. And I think that's what attracted me to it in the first place. Sort of gave me a platform, you know, through other people's words, through writing, other people's writing. Yeah.
So when did you decide to become an actor? Like, how did this go from being the shy, the tree up the back to like the woman you are now?
I had in high school some teachers that really influenced me and supported me, and Colleen Comerford and Leslie Mitten and Patricia Yeldon, who were all sort of mentors and really encouraged me in my teenage years. And I used to teach drama for, you know, young children and stuff like that. So I was, you know, I always really loved drama, but I thought that I would go into teaching. So I went to Sydney Uni to do English history teaching, and then I fell in with the Sydney University Dramatic Society with SUDS, and that had a lot of people like Lucy Bell and Patrick Nolan and Chris Mead, all those people who had gone through just a bit before me. Yeah, I fell in with that lot, fell in with a bad lot at Sydney University. And so I was very distracted by all of that, and that's where I found my interest in it. And I remember I'd been sort of doing a lot of sort of silly productions in the cellar, which were great fun. And then one day I landed this role that was, you know, very serious. I remember I was wearing a skivvy and I was doing some very earnest acting, and people went, oh wow, okay, she's really got something. And then they friends encouraged me to audition for NIDA, and I think I was 19 and I got in. And I think if I hadn't got in, I'm not sure I would have auditioned again. I think I would have bruised too easily if I hadn't got in, but I was lucky enough that, you know, I fit in with that group of people that year. And so began the journey of 3 years at NIDA and everything else afterwards. Yeah.
So how was it coming out of NIDA, such an institution and kind of protected, I suppose, and then was it an easy transition out into work?
Oh, it was much easier than it is now. I mean, we were all offered agents, you know, we were all offered at least one or two agents. And I think that now that's not the case coming out of school. I think it can be very tricky to land yourself an agent straight away. So really, you did your 3 years at NIDA, and then you were sure to kind of have a entry into the industry, really. Mm-hmm. And I was very theatre focused too. I mean, then okay. We only did a little bit of camera training. I thought, no, the stage is what I want to do. And I was lucky enough to go straight into work at the Sydney Theatre Company. And that sort of started my love of stage.
So what was that role? Were you wearing a skivvy? Do you remember?
Wearing the skivvy, no. I think Chris Mead had written the play himself, but I know I just remember seeing a photograph of me in a white skivvy looking, very, very earnest, very self-important. Yeah. I thought, oh, there we go. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So you say that, you know, obviously the theatre and the transition out from schooling's changed. Has it changed also the atmosphere of, I mean, obviously this year is unique, so we're changed forever probably, but the evolving kind of theatre world, like, has it changed much over the times that you've been on stage?
I suppose coming out of drama school now, I've noticed that a lot of people sort of really want to take that path to LA. A lot of people are very, I've got to get screen work and I've got to get a profile, and, you know, if I want to do some theatre, that'll be fun, but predominantly I'll want to go for screen work. So I think that's more of the focus now for people coming out of drama school. Certainly, I'm seeing that there's a lot more opportunity for diversity and for roles for women, which is fantastic compared to what they used to be. I mean, we were really encouraged just to be the love interest or the mum or the, you know, back in the day. And I remember my agent saying to me, well, it's all over when you're 40. So, you know, you've really got to make hay while the sun shines. And not my agent now, this is my former agent. You know, you really got to go for it now. And really, probably some of the most interesting work happened for me after 40. So, you know, it's a very different time now.
And that brings us a little bit to A Room of One's Own, which is very about being a woman of the time. How does that sit now? So could tell us a little bit about it. So I know it was a lecture, an essay, and then a book, and I read the book years ago.
If we did the whole essay in its entirety on stage, it would be about 6.5-7 hours probably. Yeah. But what Tom Wright and Carissa Licciardello have done is distilled it, really. So it still has these 6 chapters, but they've been condensed and truncated into something that people can consume in an hour and 20 minutes. So it's still very dense. There's still a lot to absorb in that time. But okay. I think the way that they've crafted it is really quite brilliant. And there's also a design element in our production, which really helps those ideas pop. And it's been such a joy to do. But, yes, I there are so many parallels with today. She wrote this in 1928, around about 1928, and now we're still thinking, yeah, there's a lot there that hasn't changed.
Right. How so? Like what?
Well, probably, you know, for women, things like equal pay, equal respect, or all those sorts of things. She talks about how a woman needs material things to, or any kind of artist needs intellectual freedom, and to have intellectual freedom, you need material things. So you can't be spending your days worried about how do I keep this roof over my head? How do I feed my children? How do I, or, you know, all these sorts of things. It just gives you no room to dream or to work artistically if your life is consumed with those things. So she kind of goes back in history and says, well, the very first female writers were ladies, you know, they were of nobility. They weren't the common person.
They were supported, basically.
That's right. And then from the 16th century, we go through and we look at, okay, so when the middle-class woman started writing, she wrote novels. She wasn't in a room, her own study, where she had all the reference books out and, you know, her complete works of Shakespeare or anything like that. She was hiding and scribbling her novel in a corner and hoping that no one would interrupt her or come in. So she sort of looks at, you know, that kind of 18th century you know, flow of those novels, like, you know, the Jane Austens and the Charlotte Brontes and all those people. And then she kind of looks at where she's at and goes, well, okay, so I'm not consumed with anger and bitterness about the fact that I don't have the freedom to write in the way that men do, like these former female writers have, mm-hmm. the women before me. But there is still that element. And she kind of lands with the idea that in about 100 years' time, which mm-hmm. for us is about 8 years from now, yeah. conditions will be right for women in which she will be able to write with the equal conditions that men have in terms of environment, pay, all those other social conditions. So it's quite an extraordinary thought journey that she takes us through history and looking to this woman of the future. So she says that this woman will be born, this female Shakespeare, whoever she'll be, will be born. But we all have to work towards that. We all have to work towards having, 500 Branding a year together. And a room of her own. Yeah.
A call to arms sort of.
It's been a very rewarding piece to do.
Reading it, it is such an internal and a thought and feeling. How is that transformed to stage dialogue? Is it dialogue between you and Ella Prince, or is it
no it's actually verbatim, so they literally have truncated the her essay word for word, so they've just kind of picked out the gems or the threads that they think will work and weave together. So Ella is in a space of her own. We're both in rooms of our own.
Love it.
Yeah, so she's part of this visual landscape that supports the Virginia's words.
So how is it now on the stage? And how do you kind of carry the energy that maybe was it easier when there's more people? How is it going?
Yeah, we started off with about a third capacity. So it was like about 110, 115. Yeah. And then some people were still maybe a little bit nervous about coming along. So sometimes we just have, maybe 90 or 100 people.
Yeah.
And that went really, really well, but it did feel a little empty. Because it's kind of a direct address to the audience, it sort of worked in that way. Like, it's not a raucous comedy, right? So you don't need, like, we're not waiting for the big belly laughs or anything like that. The piece still worked in that way. But now that we've got half capacity, so that's like an extra 30 people maybe, you really feel the richness and fullness of the auditorium all of a sudden. Like, you really feel that people are there and they're really present and they're much more vocal. So it's been really fantastic. I think the show's really hit its stride in the last week or two because, I mean, really, this is the thing. This is what theatre's about. It is an exchange between performer and audience. So I really feel them out there and I feel supported, and that feeds into my work. And so it's been a real reminder of that and a real lesson in how we it's a conversation.
You're listening to Stages. I'm Regina Botros and we are talking with actor Anita Hegg. So you've done so many productions over the years. Is there a particular one that sits for you as, like, significant and or proud of, or something that was most challenging? Or, like, I mean, you've done so many, so it's probably hard to choose.
I think that you remember things from your youth a lot more. Mm-hmm. And I think probably when I did Rosalind in As You Like It, Simon Phillips directed it back in 1996 or 98 or something like that.
Yeah.
So, and that was at the Drama Theatre in the Opera House. And I remember thinking, wow, here I am in the Sydney Theatre Company playing this role. And I'm not sure I was particularly very good, but I know Kerry Bedell was great. She was singing. It was kind of like a jazz version of the play. It was really wonderful. They had a fantastic score of music that she sang, but I really felt like, wow, okay, this is what I've always wanted. You know, this is the dream. So that was probably, I think I was 23, 24 then. So that was quite a significant moment for me. And there've been little things along the way. Like, I remember I worked with Peter Evans on a show called Yellow Wallpaper, which was another one person show. And that was like a really special thing because that was kind of the first kind of thing I felt like I had creative input into in terms of how the work was developed. So that was a really special thing. And then working with Benedict Andrews on the Martin Crimp play, The City, Gross and Klein, that starred Cate Blanchett, and we got to go on tour with that. We got to go to Paris and London and Vienna.
Wow.
That was really exciting. Things like that. Working with Kit Williams recently on Arturo Uy, Harp in the South. They've been really, amazing career.
Lots of highlights.
So how do you prepare for a stage? How do you maintain the kind of, I don't know, stamina, I suppose?
Yeah, so when we started rehearsal, we had about a week in the room at Belfast Street, and then we had to stop. I had a 4-month-old, and I had about half a script in my head, I think. about half of it by that stage because I started learning it last Christmas. I thought, I know, with a baby, I thought I've got to get onto this early. And Chris was fantastic. She, you know, we'd Zoom and keep working on the script together and work on the lines together. So that was really great. And then, you know, we'd go back and we'd have another 2 weeks and we had to stop. And, you know, so it was kind of sporadic over a 5-6 month period. But I think there was a real benefit because that work was just sort of swimming around in my brain, even though I wasn't looking at it every day or, you know, I'd done that work. Sometimes I look back and go, wow, would I have made it? I probably needed to have the whole thing in my head learnt, you know, if we hadn't had to stop. And I think maybe we would have just been watching an actor standing on stage just trying to remember their lines. You know, I don't know if I would have been able to inhabit it as well as, you know, we've been able to. So, you know, that having that amount of time and space has had some benefits as well as, you know, of course, the disruptions have been difficult too, particularly for the designers and the creative. So, yeah, it's been very, very tricky. But in terms of preparation now, I really do feel like it's in me. When my warm-up is I go on stage and I go through bits of each section just to kind of and remind myself where I'm going with it because it is a very complicated thought journey and you have to really be conscious of where you're directing it or else I think you can confuse people. The idea is to try and keep the ideas as clear and of the utmost importance, you know, it's about the ideas and you can't, if you start muddying it, you can lose people, I think. So I just have to really be conscious of where I'm going with it. Objectives, there you go, actions and objectives, those sorts of things. So I've, you know, it's just a little process of that and then a little bit of a vocal warm up and away we go. It's a real joy to do because it's so funny. Virginia Woolf talks about Coleridge in this and she says this wonderful thing about Coleridge. She says, when one takes a sentence of Coleridge into the mind, it explodes and gives birth to all kinds of other ideas. And that is the only sort of writing of which one can say that it has the secret of perpetual life. And that's how I feel about Virginia's work. So when I'm on stage saying these words, I'm going, I don't think I could ever get sick of saying these because they're so deep and they're so rich and there's so much in them and they make you think about other things all the time. And it's really extraordinary privilege to be able to work with this text.
Yes. It seems so right for you as well, being initially wanting to be an English history teacher and now you're kind of lecturing in another way, but yet inside the performer of you.
Yeah. It's interesting.
I'm inspired to go and read it again and try and get in the last few days to come and see it. What is the most important thing for you as a creative, like to survive, if you were going to give advice to other actors that were, you know, wanted to follow in your footsteps?
I think be really clear about what it is that you want to do. I think I've always been an actor that goes, oh yeah, well, I'll try this. I just sort of float around and if someone says to me, what is it that you want to do? I've never really had an answer for that. But I think looking back, I think that would have been useful. I think if you know, okay, just have some roles that you want to play. If stage is what you want to do, you know. Otherwise, if you're into film and TV and all that kind of stuff, you really need to understand that it's about much more than the acting. You've got to understand the business of it, I think. Okay. So much of it is about that as opposed to just, you know, it's talent and all of that. Yeah, but it's really, I think it's really important to know those things. Resilience, you know. I'll do another, can I say one more Virginia?
Yeah, program? No, totally.
She talks about the difficulty that it is for writers or, and in our heads, we're going, any artist really, in the society that we live in, because what does she say? She talks about the world's notorious indifference to artists. She says that the world does not ask them to write poems or novels or histories. It does not need them. And so the writer suffers, especially in the creative years of youth, every form of distraction and discouragement. If anything comes through in spite of all this, it is a miracle, she says. And she's talking about writers. And I think it applies to artists as well. You know, no one says, you know, we need lawyers, we need doctors, we need people to work at Woolworths, we need people to clean houses, we need people to make buildings. But no one goes, we need actors, you know what I mean? So you have to have an extraordinary resilience, I think, and you have to believe that what you do is important. And it is important because art reflects back to us who we are, you know. That shared communal experience of sitting in a theatre enriches our humanity and shows us, you know, it touches us, it creates empathy, it teaches us values, it affirms our values. You know, it's a very important thing, but somehow we've managed to not make it as important as cricket. I don't know why. Mm-hmm. So it's you have to have a lot of resilience. Doesn't mean you have to be pig-headed or anything like that. It's not mm-hmm. about that. It's about self-belief and believing in the value of what it is that you do and that it is important in society. Yeah,
absolutely. So is there a role that you'd like to play?
Yeah, see, still can't answer the question. I think this was probably it. I think this was...
Oh, yay!
Yeah.
Oh, it was brilliant. Well, Anita Hegg, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
And that was Anita Hegg, the esteemed actor, and she won Best Actress and Most Popular in the Time Out magazine in 2012. I love that. Get along and see A Room of One's Own if you can. You only have till this weekend, but hopefully next year it will be back in a return season. Fingers crossed for that. Stick around. Trisha Stars is coming up shortly with some What's On.